were talking about helping farmers return to work following a devastating accident on the farm. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. For over 30 years, Agra Ability of Wisconsin has been working to help farmers with disabilities and their families, and they cite that over 4,000 injuries occur on Wisconsin farms each year, many resulting in permanent disabilities. Join in on farm-related injuries, questions about getting support, 800-642-1234. Jeff Crotawill is Program Director of Easter Seals Wisconsin Farm Program. Jeff, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Good morning. So Agra Ability has helped thousands of farmers and farm families who've needed assistance to continue working. What is the range of this help that people can receive through the program?
Sure. Agra Ability of Wisconsin is a partnership between the Easter Seals Farm Program, where I work, as well as with UW Extension, who helps complete our outreach activities. Our main priorities on the AgriAbility project are to provide assistive technology resources. So we're talking to farmers who have had an accident, or maybe they have a medical condition that limits their ability to farm. And then we talk about ways that, what can we do to change those activities that they're having a hard time doing, meaning maybe some adaptations to help them get on the tractor so they can plant their crops, adaptations to milk their cows easier or feed their beef animals. And then we talk about resources to help fund those changes that we need to do.
I was just going to jump in here and ask you, before we get into those resources, can you kind of explain what the two partners bring to the program, what the Division of Extension UW-Madison brings, what Easter Seals Wisconsin brings to Agra Ability?
Sure. Easter Seals Wisconsin Farm Program is responsible for the direct client services. So we're the agency that would actually visit the farm or the farmer that's having the limitations and provide an assessment to the things that they would need in order to farm easier. And then the UW Extension provides the outreach services. So they're the persons that you're going to see at the farm trade shows. They also have in several counties, or many of the counties, county extension agents who can help provide some further resources if we need it.
So quite a collaboration there. Does Agra Ability serve only farmers with permanent disabilities, or is it there to also help people who will recover from an injury?
We can be involved in a person who's had an accident and there's a disability at that time. Certainly permanent disability, someone who's had some short-term limitations, we're happy to meet with them and provide the type of resources or information that they need in order to farm.
I imagine each situation is different. Each case you work on is different. What are some things that do often come up, some injuries on the farm that you have worked on a lot over the years?
Yeah, that's a very good question and point. Every farm is different. Every farmer is different in terms of the accident or injury or limitation they have. We do see a lot of farmers who have simply some significant, or not simply, but significant arthritis, who have possibly been milking cows, for example, in a stanchion barn. So repetitive bending and squatting, and have some limitations then in their knees or hips. Is a large component of the farmers that we see in terms of disability type. Unfortunately, traumatic injuries, we do see things like if their hand or arm is entangled in a power takeoff or other pieces of moving equipment. And then we do see a lot of persons who have just simply medical conditions, so not related to the farm, but possibly they've had a stroke or things like that that limit their ability to get back to work or farm. So,
talking with Jeff Crotawill, who is Helping Farmers with Disabilities Program Director of Easter Seals Wisconsin Farm Program, you can join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. Jeff, you know, an accident on the farm may cause, as you mentioned, someone to lose an appendage, someone to become an amputee. And farmers with amputations have distinct prosthetic needs. Can you talk about that?
They do have distinct prosthetic needs. it's something that, you know, thankfully there's other agencies and places to help find the right fit for a prosthetic if needed. And, you know, we're certainly happy to make a referral to those places. A lot of times when we're meeting with persons, we're just letting them know that, hey, there are options out there. There are things that can be done to make changes on the farm so that they can farm, make it easier for them with whatever injury they had. You know, and that they can go through that process of healing to the point that they can when they're ready to return to work. You know, for example, taking advantage of prosthetic needs is one of them.
How are you seeing adaptive farm technology change over the generations?
That's a good question. I think I've seen that there just is simply a lot more things that are in place and available to farmers in terms of an adaptation. You think about like tractor steps, for example. In the 1980s, the tractor steps were all very high and small, and now as you know, now the tractors come out and the steps are more in an angled fashion. They're larger in size. They have a more of a handrail. So they're being manufactured with that in mind for just to make it simpler to access to the operator station. Mm-hmm. Is one change I can think of. You know, and again, there's just a lot of different adaptations that could be obtained both, you know, and also just, you know, they're commercially available. They're available for anyone to make it easier, but especially when they meet that need for a person who had a disability, that's when it becomes a assistive change or assistive technology change for them. So
if a farmer has an injury and asks you, you know, if they're slowing down or have barriers to be able to do that job, you know, a question arises, who will backfill for me? I need to keep farm operations running. I don't have a replacement. We need to keep the money coming in. What do you tell that farmer?
Yeah, that's a very difficult difficult situation if they're unable to work and need another worker to do the work. Unfortunately, I don't have a great answer all the time for that. We try to help them out with resources such as Wisconsin Farm Center, who may have some answers there in terms of available employees to do that stuff. Also trying to meet with a family, talk about available options, and just kind of work through that process with them of who may be able to step in while they're laid up, if that's the case. Also, you know, maybe it'd be a situation where they can do some short-term restructuring to reduce the labor needs. You know, until they can start to recuperate as well as get some accommodations in place.
Looking at AgriAbilities grant funding, 2019, you got a 3-year grant from the USDA. What results to this program are you seeing from that grant funding?
So the AgriAbility funding is I believe it's actually every 4 years that we have we reapply for that grant. Mm-hmm. We have currently about 400 farmers on our CASO that we're working with throughout Wisconsin. We've served farmers in just about every county or every county in Wisconsin to do a farm assessment, to provide information to them, to provide them the resources so they can continue to farm. We also received some funds through an SDA grant. That SDA grant helps us increase our focus with veteran farmers, as well as minority farmers, which is something we have a greater emphasis on here in the last few years, and trying to help provide resources to USDA to those farmers so they can continue to farm and take advantage of those resources that might be available to them.
Is there demand unmet? Is there demand you're not able to meet beyond that 400 caseload?
Certainly, we realize that Wisconsin's is a big state and a lot of territory to cover. We currently have 7 persons that comprise of our team. You know, we're looking to expand some staff to meet that need. Funding certainly an issue. We do a annual fundraising. Golf outing this year. It'll be August 12th in the Wausau area. It's our golf event. You know, with things like gas prices and things like that. It's certainly the budget to provide all the services is challenging for the monies that we do receive. So there is certainly a lot of farmers out there that could benefit from our service that currently aren't either reaching out to us or don't know about us.
Jeff Crottewell leads the Easter Seals Wisconsin Farm Program, helps farmers in returning to farming after a disabling accident or illness. Join in with your experiences, your questions about farm safety, support efforts after an accident, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could join us. We are talking about the Easter Seals Wisconsin Farm Program, how it's helped thousands of Wisconsin farmers stay in agriculture after a debilitating farm accident. It's become a model for other programs around the country. Still time to talk. 800-642-1234. Jeff Crottewell heads up the Easter Seals Wisconsin Farm Program with us for about 9 more minutes. Jeff, when we hear Easter Seals, sometimes we don't have the connection, or I at least didn't have the connection, to farming. Easter Seals has that rich history of helping, you know, both children and adults with disabilities. Can you explain the challenges that are unique to helping farmers versus other segments of society with disabilities?
Yeah, sure. Easter Seals Wisconsin does, as you mentioned, have an excellent service related to serving children with disabilities at our camping program. And yes, our farm program within our Easter Seals Wisconsin department is a very unique program. And often persons don't make the connection that we do provide that service. And then also sometimes they get lost in the fact that agribility and making the connection that agribility includes Easter Seals Wisconsin and UW Extension. So that sometimes is our challenge. And farmers will, or persons will want to talk to agribility, not realizing that Easter Seals Wisconsin Farm Program is a portion of that. So sometimes just in terms of the partnership piece, people can get lost in.
Can you walk us through a typical application for assistance through agribility? What can someone expect? What can the farmer expect?
Yeah, the first thing is the application is really pretty straightforward to apply. The farmer, there is a, they can do a web application, which simply has name, address, phone number, best way to contact. And then talk a little bit of self-reported on their disability. It's very short. They could also make a phone call to our program and do an intake over the phone, which, again, takes a very short amount of time to do. Mm-hmm. Once they're enrolled in our program, they're assigned a caseworker or a case manager. That case manager can then do a more formalized intake with them, just talking about the type of farm that they have, the type of disability they have, the type of limitations that they're experiencing, and then try to understand the best way to proceed. Often the next step is with a farm site assessment, where myself or my colleague or one of my colleagues would visit the farm, meet face to face with a farmer, and do a tour of the farm, do an assessment to see the limitations that they have, and then just talk about options for them and best ways to proceed. There's no cost to the farmer to do that service, and we can visit the farm as many times as needed and provide other resources to other agencies as appropriate and as needed. It's confidential. It's one-on-one or as many persons as that farmer chooses to have involved in their case.
How important is it to go to the farm, see the situation, to understand what the farmer is talking about and where they're coming from?
Yeah, very, very important. As I mentioned earlier, every farm is different. So the way that they may do some of their activities would be different than the next farmer or or potentially different than other farmers. So it's important to see the situation. It's also important to see the level of impact of the disability to the point that it's limiting them, and then just talk about an appropriate option or best way to, again, proceed with that farmer. So important to see it, important to have them demonstrate it and just do a formal assessment.
Do you talk with family members or staffers on the farm?
The farmer is in control of that. So if they choose to have, if they have staff or employees, or if they have family members that they want to involve, certainly we can talk to them and just help have everyone on the same page in terms of go through options, have the farmer explain, or family members sometimes will jump in and talk about the level of clarify the level of trouble that it's been for that farmer or for the farm in general.
Jeff Crottewill with us talking about Helping Farmers with Disabilities, Program Director of Easter Seals Wisconsin Farm Program. You can join in with your experiences on the farm with worker safety, with an accident, what happened afterward, where you found support, 800-642-1234. Jeff, we were talking about the financial hit earlier, and farmers with disabilities, they can also seek funding from the Wisconsin Division of Vocational Rehabilitation to help pay for farm equipment or other assistance. What barriers do farmers face when trying to get at the financial assistance from the state?
Sure. That's something that we are working on improving. Prior to 2016, Division of Vocational Rehab typically served approximately 100 farms per year in financial support for the assistive technology needs that they had. As a result of some policy changes on their end in 2016, roughly, that was very, very limited in the number of farms that they were able to serve.
Mm-hmm.
I'm happy to report in July of 21 that they did, again, revise that policy to help make that easier access for farmers. And I do believe that is trending in the right direction in terms of their support. And they have been, we've had some great conversations with them and continue to talk with them on a quarterly basis and ways to you know, just make sure that things move forward in the right direction. And again, I believe they are. We still have a long ways to go, but things are trending in the right direction in terms of their support. And we're very happy to have them as a partner in terms of supporting farmers.
How do you manage a case when a farmer thinks they need one thing, but your evaluation and your assessments say the farmer needs a different type of support? What do you do in that situation?
Yeah, that's a good question. Sometimes those are challenging conversations. Farmers do obviously know their farm very well, and sometimes do have a set thing in mind in terms of what they need to help. Often the answer is a little bit of both, meaning both what they think and, you know, what I'm maybe suggesting could both be right. It's just important that I try to point out to consider what my recommendation and how that would work for them. You know, in the end, it's their farm and they can do what they want. But just important to just try to point it out and just be kind of clear about how that accommodation will meet the need. You know, considering maybe the cost of the accommodation or things like that. So again, I guess the short answer is it's sometimes complicated. Sure.
Sure. What about time? Because an accident happens in a split second. The farmer really needs to get back on the job, feels like they know what they need, and yet it takes time to go through the application and the steps to getting that assistance. How do you keep that moving or realize, you know, the barriers with time?
Yeah, that is very difficult, and that's a great point. The farm doesn't stop. They need to be able to work or generate the work or have it done. In terms of a person applying for our program, we typically can do a farm site assessment, and we recognize the need of time and can usually meet them within a week or so and get out to that farm pretty shortly.
Mm-hmm.
That's one thing that we talk about frequently with the Division of Vocational Rehab. If they are supporting that farm, in terms of moving the case forward and just getting that done as quickly as possible.
Jeff, thank you so much for joining us.
Appreciate it. Thank you for having me.
Jeff Crotawill, Program Director of Easter Seals Wisconsin Farm Program. We have a link to AgriAbility of Wisconsin at WPR.org/mornings. News update is next. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about what drives up the price of gas on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. President Biden earlier this month at the Port of Los Angeles fielding a reporter's question on ExxonMobil's profits.
Exxon made more money than God this year. And by the way, nothing's changed. And they're not, by the way, one thing I want to say about the oil companies. You talk about how they have 9,000 permits to drill. They're not drilling. Why aren't they drilling? Because they make more money not producing more oil.
Audio courtesy of Bloomberg. The White House last week calling for a 3-month federal gas tax holiday. It stands at 18 cents per gallon. Join in on prices at the pump, oil reserves, refining capacity, 800-642-1234. Patrick DeHaan is head of petroleum analysis for the fuel tracking website Gas Buddy. Patrick, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. You hear President Biden there saying, look, these oil companies are hiking prices more than they need to make up for expenses due to their cost to do business. Is that what is driving what is happening to the price at the pump?
It's really not. It is a global imbalance between supply and demand that has been made much worse by strains like Russia's war in Ukraine and the corresponding sanctions that the U.S. and Western countries have levied on Russia, making that oil difficult to make it to a global marketplace. In addition, things like COVID-19 upended normal driving behavior in the U.S. That caused some refineries to shut down in the early days of the pandemic. So we're in a situation right now where there's simply not enough oil on the global market with the loss of that Russian oil. In addition, refining capacity is constrained because of various shutdowns over the last couple of years. But it is true that oil companies are obviously making more money as oil prices are higher. But that does not necessarily mean that oil companies get to set prices. What we're experiencing is very similar to the U.S. housing market, where there's a lack of available homes and too many buyers lining up to buy that home. And so you have median home prices have shot up, very similar to what is going on in crude oil markets.
Okay, so you're saying that there's the war in Ukraine, there's the pandemic, there's the sanctions on Russia and Russia's oil, there are trade wars. So given all of these, you know, shocks to the economic system, the marketplace, what does that have to do with prices at the pump?
Well, all of those shocks are what have caused the price at the pump to go up. These shocks, these are jolts to the system in that you have demand which is recovering as the economy continues to flourish. Americans are hitting the road in very high numbers as we do during a normal summer, but there's been a pent up amount of demand because the economy was not as open last summer or the summer prior. So demand has very much recovered. The problem is through some of these issues like Russia's war in Ukraine and corresponding sanctions, oil has been removed from the global supply of it. In addition, there's less ability to take what oil is available and to turn it into things like gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. And so for that reason, not only is oil high, but because of the choke point then at the refining level, there's simply not enough gasoline and diesel and jet fuel being produced. And that's why the cost of all three of those has just skyrocketed.
So President Biden then calling on Congress to stop collection of the federal gas tax for 90 days. How much of an impact does the gas tax have on the overall cost at the pump?
Well, today's price, the wholesale cost, or at least I'll look at the retail price, the national average, about $4.88 a gallon. That 18.4-cent federal gas tax levy amounts to less than 4% of what you pay at the pump. So while it is a factor, and while eliminating it for 90 days would bring prices down, we're talking about not a substantial sum. Now, most states have gasoline taxes that are higher than their federal counterpart. So that could bring relief. And President Biden had encouraged states to waive their state gasoline taxes. But of course, that remains to be seen. And the problem is that lowering prices may incentivize Americans to go out and consume more gasoline, diesel, at a time that there's simply not enough supply to meet that demand. So lowering prices could exacerbate the situation that has led to these record high prices.
And a lot of economists now pointing to the Penn Wharton budget model study that keeps coming up, looking at states that did do the gas tax holidays in March, found that about 70% of the savings from a gas tax holiday were passed on to the consumer. Refineries got the rest of that savings, the rest of that profit. So what do you see there when you look at that type of analysis on what a tax holiday could yield?
Well, there's a lot of types of analyses that are run after that. And I don't know, you know, who behind the scenes is looking into these. I can tell you that there's a lot of nuances on how prices work, how quickly they come down, even things like how those laws are written. There's a massive difference between Georgia and Maryland and how they wrote their gas tax holiday legislation. And that's why in Georgia, the price decrease took a lot more time. And I would expect that study would have showed that maybe less of the dip was passed along. But I find a high degree that those taxes were passed along, but it really just depends on how the law is written, how quickly stations pass along those decreases. And so there's a lot there.
Our governor, Governor Evers, issued an executive order banning price gouging for sales of gas and diesel. How much price gouging could be going on?
Well, stations are simply passing along their higher costs. The money is not made at the station level. And a very good margin over the course of the year, maybe 20 cents a gallon on average. So as you get closer to the pump where you're dispensing that gasoline, there's less money. More of the money is made the higher up in the chain you go, at the refinery or the oil producer where the oil is actually coming out of the ground as well. So, you know, by the time you get down to the station level, there's very little. And by the way, price gouging, the president has used that term several times, but keep in mind again that this is a global market that determines prices. Oil companies were selling oil during COVID for $10 to $20 a barrel. They sold for $60 a barrel at some points in 2021. They sell at whatever the prevailing market price is, whether it's high or low. And so do oil companies simply selectively price gouge? So it doesn't really hold water, the argument that oil companies are price gouging today, but they didn't in 2020. This is simply the price that is simply a function of global supply and demand. Mm-hmm. Right now, that balance is vastly out of balance.
Patrick DeHaan, head of petroleum analysis at Gas Buddies, we talk about gas prices, telling us oil being a free and global market, many economic and geopolitical things affecting it as we look at all of those implications and forecast for fuel prices ahead of July 4th holiday. Join in with your questions on gas and fueling, 800-642-1234. So, as you look at the supply constraints, Patrick, you know, OPEC expected to publish its first demand forecast for 2023 next month. And then there's the International Energy Agency also has its demand forecast. What are they seeing about how long these constraints are going to be with us?
Well, I think for quite some time. The problem is that the Russian invasion of Ukraine, which is one of the biggest reasons for the rising price of oil or the higher price of oil, may not disappear anytime in the next 3 or 6 or 9 months, or it could. It's certainly a very uncertain situation there. But the imbalance without Russia's oil, we are still going to be in this predicament. Not only that, but we have a lack of refining capacity. As you may have heard, as we've navigated demand recovering from pre-COVID, or I should say from COVID levels, those shutdowns at refineries have really really held us back in terms of being able to adequately supply the market. So it's really not only an issue with Russia, but bringing back, potentially bringing back or adding to what refining capacity we have. We've lost about 1 million barrels a day of refining capacity, or 5% of the nation's total capacity. So that's really a rising story. That may not be a quick one to solve, and we may be in this for a year or two with elevated prices, but we may see some rounds of relief.
Tom from Burlington called, couldn't stay with us, and Tom says that, look, people should drive their cars less if they want gas prices to come down. They also say that our country's public transportation system needs to improve as well. Is Tom onto something there, Patrick, that if we all just drive less, the gas prices will stabilize or come down?
Well, driving less or driving more fuel efficiently. The end game here is to reduce demand, and you can do that to the extreme by driving less if that's possible. But even when you're driving to a destination, just driving more fuel efficiently, things like reducing your speed 10 or 15 miles an hour. There's a reason back in the 70s at the height of the Arab oil embargo that the federal government reduced speed limits because your vehicle is more efficient, a little bit slower at 55 and 60 miles an hour, and your fuel efficiency rises dramatically. So not only cutting consumption, combining trips, but when you do have to make a trip, trying to drive more fuel efficiently, avoiding those rapid jackrabbit starts and shutting your car off, you're going to be idling more than, say, 10 or 15 seconds. Using your cruise control and setting it for maybe 55 or 60 will have a profound effect on how much fuel we're consuming as a nation.
Someone once told me, think of putting an egg under your foot on the gas pedal and try not to crush that egg as you step on the gas. Do it very gingerly. Is there something to that?
Absolutely. Acceleration, mashing on the pedal and crushing that egg, is absolutely also going to destroy your fuel efficiency. So absolutely thinking of it that way, you know, being a little bit lighter footed, will go a long way. And that's where a lot of gasoline is being consumed, and Americans drive it inefficient in the way that they may accelerate significantly only to face a light, you know, quarter or half mile down the road. So try to anticipate what the next traffic light looks like. And instead of accelerating towards a red light, try to coast to it.
Gas Buddies, head of petroleum analysis, Patrick DeHaan with tips, fielding questions on prices at the pump, what variables impact the price of a gallon going forward. Still time for you on fuel prices, reserves, drilling, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Patrick DeHaan on The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're discussing gas prices at the highest level in history. What factors are leading to this moment? Shout out to Madeline in Oneida on our caller-only program earlier this month, wanting us to talk about gas prices and the history of fuel supply shortages. Also, thanks to Sarah in Madison, who requested a program about gas prices on the form on our program page at WPR.org/mornings. Join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. Gas Buddies head of petroleum analysis, Patrick DeHaan, with us for about 9 more minutes. Let's bring in a question from Jeremy in Racine. Jeremy, hi. What do you want to ask?
I think stick my call. I'm curious, what is our future outlook in increasing our refining capacities? Our refineries around the country are basically tweaked for specific types of crude from wherever it is they purchase the crude from. And the more the United States withdraws from the world theater in regards to patrolling the oceans and oil lanes, oil will start becoming more generalized by a certain location of the world. So Middle Eastern would be more for Middle Eastern consumption. What are we going to do in the future? Because this is not going to stop. It's only going to continue as the years move on and people become more centralized. So I'm more concerned about what is our refining capacity right now, and are we looking at increasing that in the future?
Jeremy, thank you. Patrick?
Well, you know, in terms of the U.S., we haven't built a major refinery in quite some time since the 70s. Having said that, many refineries have modernized in the last, call it two decades or so. As you mentioned, some areas of the country are more set up to process light sweet crude oil that's generally imported. Here in the Midwest, in the Great Lakes, we process a lot of Canadian heavy sour. Our refineries here in this region are more adept at being able to process heavier oil, but less light crude oil. So, you know, I don't think the U.S. is going to have a good answer for that right now. And that's just because refining has typically been very much a bust. That is, profit margins have been extremely unreliable, though we're in a period where the crack spread or profit refineries make is at historic highs because of a lack of capacity. I don't know if there's anything that the Biden administration will implement that could bring any refining capacity online that has gone offline. And so that's the struggle. There are some projects though coming online in Texas, for example, in the next year. But more of the increase in refining capacity will be happening outside our borders in the Middle East and Asia, which of course, you know, having refining capacity elsewhere will help. But again, it's out of our control as well as Americans. So I don't think there's going to be a great answer for increasing refining capacity in the U.S. anytime soon.
Also, refineries go offline for maintenance. Refineries can also go offline for hurricanes.
Yeah, exactly. And that is what worries me here this summer with an above average hurricane season forecast. There is a likelihood that we still could see a super spike in prices later this summer. If we do see refining capacity shut down, that certainly could be very painful.
Let's go to Frank in La Crosse with a question. Frank, what's on your mind?
Thanks for taking my call. So I'd like the guest to address one reason for high prices that is seldom mentioned, and that's the Wall Street speculation on future purchases, where typically Wall Street investment groups will add anywhere from $10 to $30 per barrel before it ever hits the point of consumption and the cost that we pay. It's so seldom mentioned as a real reason for price gouging. So I'd like his comments on that because I don't think it's been mentioned today.
Yes, Frank, thank you. Patrick, what about speculators in the futures?
Well, you know, this year has been a very interesting year, and the volatility has brought on changes. The CME in Chicago has increased margin requirements, meaning it's a little bit more challenging given the volatility. You have to be a bigger player to be able to cover those margins. And so there's a little bit less liquidity in oil. But having said that, there's been a tremendous inflow of money that's positioned for a long term of higher oil prices. So, you know, speculators, they always, you know, that's an easy answer to say speculators. But keep in mind, the fundamentals are the primary reason why speculators may get in or out. They're not necessarily boosting prices significantly, but it's the events that they chase. So there is money flowing into oil. But as we've seen in the last couple of weeks, oil prices have fallen nearly $15 a barrel, well, with the exception of yesterday. So those speculative flows, they come in, they go out as well. But overall, it's because of our severely crimped ability to produce oil and refine it that prices are so high.
Frank, thank you for that question. Patrick DeHaan with us, head of petroleum analysis at Gas Buddy. We heard from Jill in Sussex, called in, couldn't stay with us. Jill is frustrated that gas prices can vary wildly between different gas stations. And Jill wonders, why is that the case, Patrick? And if something can be done to regulate those prices from one gas station to another?
I think regulation actually have the inverse effect of what you're hoping. It would probably mean that lower stations go up and the higher prices that you're seeing would stay there. Regulation in gas prices, Hawaii, for example, tried to cap the wholesale price of fuel. It lasted about 6 months before that legislation was removed because restrictions or, you know, it's tempting to say, I want the good deal all the time. But instead of getting a good deal, what happens with legislation is the good deals usually disappear replaced by higher prices. So the root of the problem here with why prices vary is because gasoline is a commodity. There can be an issue one day that leads the wholesale price of gasoline to jump 25, 35, 45 cents a gallon. And stations on average refuel their tanks every 3 to 5 days or so. So there can be tremendous differences. The price of oil, as you may watch, fluctuates and can fluctuate wildly some days. Back in, I think it was April or May, the price of diesel, the wholesale price, the price stations pay, jumped 75 cents a gallon one day, only to decline a dollar a gallon the next.
Wow.
Imagine being a station that paid that higher price and then having a competitor that scored the dollar a gallon lower price. That's kind of what I'm trying to hint at here. Everyone is paying a different price at the station level. And that's why it's important for motorists to shop around and be aware of those lower prices.
Is it worth then driving out of your way to visit a gas station with lower prices?
Well, you know, I would never advocate for simply going out of the way just for the sole purpose of filling up, because obviously driving out of your way can also mean you're burning more gasoline, and there's the ill-intended consequence of boosting consumption to chase a price that may save you a couple cents. I always say, you know, if you can change your route, maybe go to a different grocery store in a different part of town that brings you closer to that station, or if you have errands to run, you know, trying to change or deviate my schedule instead of going out of your way, that's probably the best way to do it.
Build it into your schedule. So very quickly, a few seconds left here, July 4th coming up, lots of people hitting the roads. What might we expect with prices at the pump?
I'm hoping we'll continue to see the prices falling. That's what we've seen. Wisconsin's average down 11 cents a gallon in the last week. If you're a smart shopper, you can find it under $4.40 a gallon. That downward trend may continue through July 4, but beyond that, there is the risk that we could go back up. And like I said, if there's a major hurricane, we could still see a super spike at some point in August.
Patrick, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Patrick DeHaan is head of petroleum analysis at Gas Buddy. And thanks again to Madeline in Oneida, Sarah in Madison for requesting this gas prices discussion. Share your program requests anytime. Email ideas at WPR.org or visit our program page, WPR.org/mornings. Just ahead, we talk with a group of experts on incarcerated parents and how their sentences affect the kids. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.